This is an ABC podcast.
Jeff Goodfellow grew up in a working class Adelaide family. Jeff tried his hand as a boxer and then as a builder's labourer, but an accident on a building site left him unable to lift anything heavy. So in desperation, Jeff turned to a different kind of life. He became a poet. And he was a poet with a specific audience in mind, people like him. Jeff wrote that he set out to write for ordinary Australians, the people that get forgotten, the people that vacuum the room, the people that get up on a ladder to change a light bulb, the people who fix the heater, the plumber who unblocks the toilet. Despite his back injury, Jeff kept himself at a high level of physical fitness, and he maintained a boxer's physique into his 60s. In other words, Jeff is as tough as old boots, and his poetry can be fierce too. But there is great tenderness and insight as well. When Jeff and I sat down to have a conversation in 2011, there was another thing to notice about him. He had a long scar running from his ear, down the side of his neck, round to his throat. And that scar was part of the story of the collection of poems he'd just published called Waltzing with Jack Dancer.
Hello, Jeff.
G'day, Richard. How are you?
I'm very well, and you're looking alarmingly well, I must say, for a bloke who's been through what you've been through.
Well, I've been working hard at looking alarmingly well too, Richard. I've been up every morning at 6 o'clock and doing the push-ups and the sit-ups and lifting the weights and down the beach and kilometre ocean swimming every morning and a run. And, you know, I work hard at it 6 days a week to try and maintain some degree of physical fitness and to get back to that hard little man that I was a couple of years ago.
I was at your book launch, and H.G. Nelson launched it, and there was a Supreme Court judge there and a lot of different people as well. There was a lot of love for you in that room, Jeff.
It was fantastic. I mean, I reckon around about 250 people in the room, a real diverse range of people from all walks of life. There were other judges there, magistrates, painters, plumbers and electricians and floor tilers and a range of people who were probably unemployed too.
Yeah, well, that's just it. That's always your mission. As I said, it's to reach as many people as you possibly can. And to that end, I know you've read your poetry in prisons and in places for people who have mental illnesses and all sorts of different places, as well as some of the poshest private schools in Adelaide, Jeff.
All sorts of places. I'm looking for as broad an audience as I can find. And what I want to do is explain working class people to middle class Australia too. And I think that's important. Give people who might underestimate working class people a close look at what the lives of people can be like who perhaps aren't really as silly as what they might think.
Let's talk about your background. It's kind of Australia that's changed a lot. It's not quite the way it used to be.
Yeah, I mean, you can't distinguish class like you used to be able to, I don't think. You know, I'm 60 years of age now, but I'm certain that when I was 20 years of age, it was much easier to distinguish who was who.
Where did you grow up, Jeff?
I grew up not far from the studios here in ABC at Collinswood. I grew up in Copley Street at Broadview. It was a street full of war service homes, and I moved in there in 1950 with my mother and father, sister who was 12 months, 11 days older. There were two other boys born following that, and a few other children born too that were miscarried and stillborn. Mum had eight and kept four.
Your dad is a very large figure in your life and in your poetry as well. You wrote a collection of poems called Poems for a Dead Father. How long ago did your dad pass away, Jeff?
It's 10 years ago now. He was a very interesting character, a very complex man. He was extremely talented. He was a technical and scientific glassblower, but he came back from the Second World War with post-traumatic stress disorder, or what would be diagnosed today as post-traumatic stress disorder. And he was a big drinker, and he was a little fella. He didn't take alcohol too well. He was always sort of medicated because of a bit of shrapnel that was floating around in his skull. Made him epileptic, so he was taking medication for epilepsy and drinking heavy. He could be a hard little man to deal with.
He was a rat of Tobruk, wasn't he, Jeff?
He was, yeah.
And he had shrapnel embedded in his head?
His skull, yeah.
His skull?
And you could feel it at various times. When we were kids, we'd sit around the kitchen table and he'd say, "Cop this," and he'd pull the sleeve up and there'd be a bit of shrapnel poking up in his arm and he'd say, "Feel that, that's a bit of shrapnel." anyway, you know, the next morning there'd be stitches down his arm and he'd had that bit of shrapnel taken out and feel this bit up in the scon, you know, cop that, you know.
Cop that.
They won't take that bastard out, you know.
What was that like for you to touch the shrapnel in your dad's head?
Yeah, well, we thought it was quite normal, I suppose. You grow up in the inner northern suburbs of Adelaide in those days, you know, there was a bus every hour and a half if you wanted to move out of the suburb, you know, it was dirt roads. No one went anywhere. We had no car, so we weren't mobile. I mean, you stayed in the street, you lived in the street, you played in the street. I thought the madness that I was surrounded with as a child was in
normal.
Every street.
In every,
I thought it was quite
family.
Normal. And it wasn't until I was probably around about 12 years of age that I started to wake up that there were other suburbs where people didn't live that hadn't been to the war and were quite sane and lived quite normal lives. And it really made me aware of the fact that if there is a war, I will not be putting my hand up.
When he had one of his rages, his alcohol-infused rages, were you called upon to try and calm him or hold him down, Jeff?
Well, I often used to tie him up. I'd tie his hands together behind his back. I'd tie his ankles together, and then I'd tie his ankles to his wrists, and I'd often gag him to shut him up too.
Were these epileptic fits or just alcoholic rages?
No, these alcoholic rages. He'd come home and he'd be likely to, you know, smash the house to pieces, you know, like he'd wipe out the crockery cupboards and upend the kitchen table and pick up a bottle of tomato sauce and make a map of Australia on the wall with it.
Was he full of remorse the next day, or did he just
always,
not talk about
always,
it?
Always, yeah. He was a very lovable man when he was sober. He was a very hard man to walk away from.
It's pretty corrosive for a man, isn't it, to have these rages and then the next day be so full of remorse and shame. I'm sure it ate away at him, Jim.
Oh, it did. He was a very tender man too in many respects, and you know, he's capable of offering great advice, not just to his own family, but to an extended family of people that relied on Johnny for sound advice. When he was sober, you know, he could have been anything, but I was aware too that he could have been anything, and I decided at a very early age that I wasn't going to have a drink, and it's made a difficult life for me. But you know, I've maintained that stance too. I'm committed to the idea that that's the way I've got to run my life.
What are the positive aspects of your dad you've tried to keep with you and make your own, Jeff?
The humanity that he showed people. You know, he'd run into someone in the pub that was a bit like him, that was off the planet and whose family had dumped them, and he'd bring them home and they'd have a bed at our place, and we didn't have very much, but whatever we had, we shared. Examples like that, and a boy that I went to school with, he was from a family of 13 kids and their house hadn't been painted for a long time, and the old man had, you know, a stack of paint that he'd got from somewhere, you know, which had probably been obtained in a probably scurrilous way, but, you know, they got the paint. People came to him, you know, that had been pinched for drink driving, you know, that he would be able to offer legal advice too. I mean, he wasn't a legal man, but he had an understanding of how the law operated. He was interested, and he was very articulate. He had the ability to use language in terrific ways. He was a great storyteller and a thoroughly entertaining man.
Aha, storytelling.
He was. I mean, he was an Irish Catholic, so I guess that I was lucky enough to grow up in that Irish Catholic household where the spoken word counted, and where when he came home, the radio would go off. You know, I grew up pre-television, and we would sit at the kitchen table and we would have to tell our stories for the day. Not only would we have to tell our stories for the day, but we would have to use the accents of the day that we had heard. I mean, I went to school with Theo Calamaris and Pellegrino Adubo, and I would have to imitate their accents. And then I might have gone to school with, you know, John Bell, who'd just arrived from Scotland, so I'd have to do a Scottish accent. He'd say, no, it's not like that. And then he'd go into it and he'd perfect the accent and he'd say, now say it again. He was a man of great theatre. When he was sober, he was so much fun to be around.
Jeff, how was your mum getting on in the midst of all this mayhem from your dad?
Well, mum did pretty well considering. Not many women, I think, would have put up with what she had to put up with. But when he was good, he was very, very good. And when he was bad, he was dreadful. But when he was good, he was great to her too. And they had a terrific relationship, which you know, had been probably the only relationship that either of them had ever had in their lives. But they they didn't go outside the bounds of that. And they could trust one another. It was, you know, like glue.
How were you at school, Jeff? How were you as a student?
Oh, dreadful.
Were you dreadful or was the school dreadful?
No, well, I guess the curriculum was dreadful, and I was dreadful in respect of, I was disrespectful. I didn't like taking orders. I still don't like taking orders. I'm not very good at taking orders. I got sent to, growing up in the suburb that I grew up in, my man didn't want me to grow up to be a bodgie, so he said that I had to go to this selective school in Adelaide. You had to do an entrance examination, and I did the entrance examination. I got accepted, and when I got there, I mean, you had to wear a suit and you had to wear a tie and, you had a blazer and a skull cap and things that I wasn't accustomed to, and I put on this grey suit, and it didn't look very good on me. Grey is not my colour, and, you know, I'm a man that likes a bit of fashion.
Yeah.
And anyway, the first morning I had to go to the school, I put on the grey suit and the grey shirt and the blue tie with the yellow stripe through it, and I thought, that doesn't look real good on me, and I thought, that blazer. And there was this bright, you know, emerald blue blazer with gold braid around it, and I took the suit coat off and put the blazer on, and I thought, now that is a bit of me. You know, I look like a bit of a ship's captain, so I think I'll wear that. So I wore the blazer to school. I didn't know. And there was no one in our family that knew. So off I go to school in the blazer. So I was in trouble on the first day. And then, you know, I used to ride home from the city, and it's a 5 miles ride on a push bike, and, you know, coming up the hill at the Buckingham Arms Hotel was hard work. So I'd take the skull cap off, and I'd take the tie off, and I'd undo the shirt, and I'd have the suit coat off, and they'd be stuffed into the kit bag, and one of the prefects would go by on the bus, and I'd be reported. So, you know, you'd get punished for that, you know, and so I finished up getting the prefect at the Broadview Football Club one night and have a stainless steel tray in a little room at the football clubs, and I went in there and ran him up and down the stainless steel tray a few times to let him know that I repeated that same trick at school too, when the science master heard the boy screaming and came in, and that was really the end of my run at that school. And I came out to Narsworth Boys Technical High School, where I really continued my slide to the bottom of the academic pecking order, which was fairly difficult at Narsworth Tech because there are a lot of contenders.
If teachers hit you, would you hit back?
I most certainly. We were always taught by our father that if anyone hits you, you hit them back, but you hit them back twice and you hit them back harder, and it doesn't matter who they are. So that got us into a lot of trouble through the course of our lives, and it wasn't until I was around about 32 years of age that I decided that, you know, that was the wrong way. By the time my father died too, he said to me before he died in a hospice just down the road from where we're sitting now, he said, I brought you bastards up the wrong way. He said, I should never have taught you how to fight. And he said, you've all got into trouble. And he said, don't bring your kids up the same way as I brought you up.
God, what happened when he said that? You must have...
Yeah, he's quite a man, you know.
That's an extraordinary thing to say,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
At least he got it off his chest, though.
He did, yeah.
Jeff, tell me about a woodwork teacher you had who had the nickname of Killer.
Yeah, I had this woodwork teacher, Killer Carney, and he would pick up chisels and mallets, and if you were doing anything wrong, he saw you doing anything wrong, whoosh, and across the room, here it comes, boom, ba-boom, 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 spinning at you, and you'd have to get your head out the way and it'd pass you by. But I was reminded around about 18 months ago, I met Bob Hunterup that I went to school with. And Bob Hunterup said, remember when your old man came up to the school when Killer Carney threw that chisel at you? He said, your old man straightened Killer Carney right up and said, you touch, go near one of my boys again, I'll come up here and I'll knock your head right off your shoulders. And he said, things pulled up after that, Jeff.
You went to his funeral.
I did go to his funeral, and I'm standing to one side of his funeral, I looked across, and there's Mr. Pamshaw, the English teacher, and he said, good fellow, he was an Indian bloke, and he said, good fellow, what are you doing here? I said, I'm here to make sure they put the dirt in on the top of him. I said, and I'll be back when it's your time too.
That's not entirely honest, is it? Because you did say that, but you were really there to at an act of kindness.
I was out of kindness. Yeah. I went to a suburban high school and I read a poem where I'd talked about Killer Carney in the classroom, and this little girl put her arm up and she said, "I think that man you're talking about is my grandfather." And I said, "What's his name?" And she said, "Ron." And I said, "Ron doesn't ring a bell with me." She said, "It's Ron Carney." I said, "Killer Carney." I said, "That's the man." I said, "Your grandpa is a hard man." I said, "He was terrible to us." And anyway, a couple of weeks later, I got an email from this little girl. A letter from this little girl. It's dreadful grammar, dreadful spelling. But what she was saying was that Killer Carney was in the Flora MacDonald nursing home, and he was going to die, and could I go and see him before he died? And I thought, what are they putting this on me for? You know, like, this is removed by, you know, decades. And I thought about it, and I thought, well, I'm here alone tonight at home. I really don't have any malice against that man. If he is going to die and his family wants me to see him, I will go. And I drove to the hospital. The hospital was closed. It was 8 o'clock. It was about 2 minutes past eight when I arrived at the front doors. The woman who ran the place saw me, looked out, and she came over and she said, "We're closed." And she said, "Was there someone you wanted to see?" And I said, "I've come to see Mr. Carney before he dies." And she said, well, "Can you come back tomorrow?" And I said, "Well, I really want to see him before he died." And she said, "Well, we're all going to die, and he's not going to die tonight." And I said, "Well, I've been contacted by his family to say that he's going to die fairly soon." And she said, "Well, it's not immediate." And she said, "Who are you? Are you a family member?" And I said, "No, I'm a former student." She said, "What sort of student?" I said, "He was my woodwork teacher." And she said, come in. She said, "Look, he's in another ward across from here." She said, "I'll take you across to meet him." She said, "He's had a stroke." And she said, "He won't be able to talk to you, but he will know who you are, and it will probably be a good thing for him to see you." So we've gone across, and he's in a locked unit. We've gone into this locked unit, and she said, "Wait out there, and I'll go and make sure he's dressed. He often becomes untidy." So I can hear him in there going, rah, 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 and I thought, oh, I really don't want to go into that room. And she came out, and she said, "You can come in now." And I said, "Look, I've heard the guttural noises." I said, "I don't know really whether I'm up to it." And she said, "I would really appreciate if you did." I said, "Okay." So I've walked in, and I've looked down at him in the cot, and I said, "G'day, Ron." I said, "Do you remember me?" I said, "My name's Jeff Goodfellow." I said, "I was one of your students at NAS with Tech in the early 60s. I said, do you remember who I am?" And he's looked at me, and he didn't say anything, but his eyes were straight on me, piercing. And I said, "Listen, you old bastard." I said, "You gave us a terrible bloody time." I said, "You're a mongrel of a man." And he sat up, and he started going, rah, 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 rah. And he's sort of in a half-sitting position, and he slumped back onto his pillow, and he's sort of rocking. And I looked down, and I said, "But I'm here to tell you that I have no malice against you whatsoever. I'm here to tell you that I'm here to speak on behalf of all the boys and tell you that you're forgiven for those acts." And I said, "You probably didn't know what you were doing. We gave you a hard time and you gave us a hard time, but I'd really like to see you kick on now." And I said, "I'm going to come back in a fortnight. I'm going to leave you for a fortnight." I said, "But I will be back in a fortnight." I said, "I'm a man of my word, and I'll be back to see you." And I said, "You get better." I said, "Because I want to speak to you about those days." I said, "You've got 14 days. And I said, "You understand me, don't you?" He made a couple of noises, and away I went. But I went back in a fortnight, and he was sitting in a wheelchair with his daughter. I said, "Come on, get out of that chair and have a crack at me now, killer." And he laughed like mad, and his daughter was really pleased. She said, I haven't seen him this animated for a long, long time. And I went back and saw him several times. And I also took my daughter, Grace. And Grace wrote a poem about Killer Carney when she was 10 years of age. But, they're the sorts of things that the lifestyle that I want to pass on to my daughter, the things that were given to me, I want to handball them on.
There is forgiveness in this world even for the Killer Carneys.
Catholics, you know.
You were a bodgy for a while, despite your dad's most earnest hopes.
No one's perfect, Richard.
No.
You know, don't give me a hard time.
I can remember Adelaide bodgy gear. I remember the Richmond Rockers in Adelaide, where they used to wear the black cardigans with the red stripe. Was that what you were wearing back in the day? Oh, or was that?
I was wearing a leather jacket and had brill cream in the hair, right, and a big wave at the front, and the skin-tight black pants and fur-lined flying boots, and I was up the Palais every Thursday night and every Saturday night, and... and hanging around the fish up on the Hampstead Road at Northfield, and going up to Victor Harbour on the weekend and terrorising people there.
You had your own boxing career for a while. There's a great poem about one of the fights you had in 1968 with a bloke called Lou Cecilia.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. You describe very well what it's like to be thinking you're going to win a fight and then realise you're not going to win the fight.
I would never go into a fight thinking that I'm not going to win. I mean, I always move forward thinking that I'm invincible. I've been knocked ass over head on many occasions, physically, but with cancer, with a back injury, with other incidents throughout my life, but I always try and move forward in a positive way. Sometimes you get beaten.
How do you do that? What gives you that conviction that you're going to win the fight?
I guess it's that strength of character, the feeling that you have inside yourself that, you are a good person and that you
deserve
doing
to
it for a reason, and you've got a reason to win too.
You were working as a builder's labourer, and this is where we come to your accident. You got married young, and
I took my first bride at age 18. I was a child groom.
The story about your back injury begins with taking both your wife and a girlfriend on a cruise.
No one's perfect, Richard. I think I've said that before, but we did go on the ill-fated
same cruise.
The ill-fated cruise, and
what made you think you could get away with that?
Well, why do people go to the races on Saturday, with a wallet full of money? They think they're going to triple it, They think they're going to have a lot of fun, and sometimes you come unstuck.
Why would you go on a holiday thinking you're going to have a good time with all the stress that would entail?
Yeah, in hindsight, Richard, I probably would have to take that tack. But as that feeling of invincibility that I have, I think that I can't be beaten. And
but you were this time.
I was.
You?
I was thoroughly defeated there. Yeah.
Did they know about each other?
They knew each other.
How did they find out, if you don't mind me asking?
Because my then wife sort of had raised suspicions and put it to me. And because she had put it to me, I had to give an honest answer. And I said, yes, you're right. And and then I copped a couple of quick left hooks, and my wife wasn't very impressed, and there was a good deal of trouble on board the ship, and I didn't know there were police officers on board the ship for security purposes, and they came down and we had words, and anyway, the next morning when we pulled into Singapore, we were escorted off the ship and flew back to Australia.
Oh, God. So after that, you spent a week with another girl. So really, the incident with your back begins with just too much horizontal dancing, in other words.
I think
Jeff.
So, yeah. I think there had been injuries caused to my back through work that had been exacerbated by horizontal dancing, as you so describe it.
Yeah. What was the final straw? What was the thing that really made your back pack it in?
A sneeze, actually. I walked across South Road and sneezed. At 2 o'clock in the afternoon, about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I was taken to hospital, and I was soon put into traction. I was in traction for a couple of weeks, and they couldn't get me straight with traction, and they wanted to operate, and I refused to have an operation, signed myself out of hospital and went home and crawled around on my hands and knees for some period of time. And it was fortuitous, really, because during that period of time that I was crawling around on my hands and knees, I crawled across a book of poetry that had been left lying on the floor by one of my sons. And I wasn't a reader. I mean, I'd grown up in a house without books. I'd grown up in a suburb where people really didn't read or didn't talk about books. They might have used the spoken word, but I'd never seen any books that vaguely resembled the sort of lifestyle that I lived in the northern suburbs of Adelaide as a kid. But one day, through boredom and the fact that I knew that I had to be in bed for the day, I thought, I'll have a look at this book. And I flipped it over and saw it was poetry. And my first response was, poetry? I'm too tough to read poetry. And I thought, no bastard's going to see me. I'll read it. So I read it from cover to cover. After reading it once, I thought, I'll read it again. I read it again, and I thought, I reckon I could write this sort of stuff myself. Initially, I could hear teachers' voices echoing down the corridors of my mind saying, you're an idiot, you're a half-wit, you'll never be any good, and the sorts of things that they said to me. But I thought, the only way I'll find out if I can do it is to have a crack at it. So I grabbed a pad and a pen, and I started to write.
podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler.
Jeff, you were telling me how a sneeze brought on your back injury and you started reading poetry for a bit of a lark and then realised you might have a go at it as well. Then there's that moment, though, once you realise you want to have a go at something like that, where, as HG says, you've got to pick up an HB pencil and put it down on a black bit of paper and make a mark. What was that like for you?
Well, it was exciting because I didn't have anything to go by other than the book that I was reading, and my notions of poetry were that poetry had to rhyme. I mean, I grew up knowing Jack and Jill went up the hill to fetch a pail of water. Silly Jill forgot the pill and now she's got a daughter. And I knew all of those nursery rhymes. And
yeah, I don't believe I heard that one in school, but
that's how Dad read it anyway. Dad was a bit naughty, you know, and Dad taught us those sorts of things. But my notions were that poetry had to rhyme. So initially I was writing this rhyming verse poetry. After I filled up the first book of poetry, I started to think, well, I wonder what other people are doing in isolation of me. And I thought, would there be any people writing poetry today? There's no one that I can ask. There's no one from our social background. I mean, I grew up in a street where men were mail sorters, truck drivers, fitters and turners, glass blowers.
But storytellers.
Storytellers, certainly.
And you had to bring music into their language, and that's how you become a compelling storyteller. You have cadence and rhythm in your speech.
Yeah, and I guess that what I did, and I've realised since, that what I've done with my writing over the years is I heard my father tell many stories throughout the course of his life, but I heard very many versions of those same stories. You know, the version I heard him tell when I was at age 5 would have been a different version that he told of the same story at age 7. It was more refined. And then when I heard the story when I was 10, it had been, you know, clipped somewhat and compressed. So I realised after I started writing that all I had to do was do what the old man did, take a basic idea and improve on that idea. I went to a library and I borrowed a swag of poetry books and read them, and most of the language wasn't the sort of language that I use. It was English language, but it was, the books smelt, the pages were yellow, and the books had been sitting in the library for a long, long time. They had no relevance to me, no connection, and no, I couldn't make any immediate connection with, you know, most of the text. So I thought, well, I'll give this poetry away. And then I thought, hang on, what I should do is go to a bookshop and buy a few books of poetry too and see what other people are doing that are perhaps a bit more modern than these people I've read in the library. So I went and bought a few books, and occasionally I was striking a poem that I enjoyed. But the thing that really came home to me was the fact that the poems that I was reading were free verse poetry and not rhyming verse poetry. And I thought, if I'm going to get published and there's no point in me writing unless I'm going to be published, I better start writing this free verse poetry. I had my first attempt at that in 1984, and I can remember writing 24 drafts of a poem called June in Hurdle Square. But after seeing that poem in print, I thought, I can write more of this sort of stuff, and away I went. And by 1986, I released my first book, No Collars, No Cuffs, which went through 9 printings, which makes it, you know, a pretty good seller.
You know, as you're telling me this, the thought has just occurred to me, you're the Ern Mallie that the Angry Penguins were looking for. The working class guy who puts down downs his tools and starts to write modern poetry.
Yeah.
And that was the hoax that was played on Max Harris and the Angry Penguins.
Yeah.
But you were the real thing.
Yeah.
You were the kind of guy they were looking for, but some decades too late for them, I
suppose. That's right. I was a few decades too late.
So when you begin to write poetry, I'm guessing you have to write, I don't know, 100 poems before you actually find your voice, really find your voice. Was it like that for you, Jeff?
I don't think so. I think that once I got onto it in 84 and got that first poem, I think that I found the recipe and I had something to say. I mean, you can't write poetry unless you've got something to say. It's important to have something to say.
And something to reveal as well.
Yeah.
Was
people,
that hard?
People want to know your secrets. I mean, that is the secret, I think, of putting out a good book, revealing the deep part that perhaps most people don't want to talk about publicly. People like seeing a bit of dirty washing hanging on the line.
Only because they recognise their own hanging next
exactly.
to it, don't they?
Exactly, yeah, and that's why, because they recognise the truth of it then.
took your poetry, as I said before, into private schools and to jails. Were there people really willing to hear what you had to say in a jail, for example?
There's always 10% of the population that will be willing to listen to you in a jail, and they're people that aren't there for a short period of time. They're people that are there for a big whack of time. Blokes have got 15 years or 17 years or 20 years to do will be the client base that you will build up in a jail, because people get sick of going to see them. Their families, you know, will go and see them for 12 months, maybe for 18 months, but then they drop off. And then there's only God to visit them, you know, and most of them don't want to see God. They don't want to see their religious practitioners that are going in there and, you know, giving away Gideon's Bibles. They're keen, though, to have conversation with people that are that understand their culture but are outside of their culture. So I found that it's always quite easy for me to get a core of people to attend the sort of workshops that I would run. But you've got to have a level of energy. You're fighting authority all the time to work in those sorts of institutions because you've got...
Sorry, you're not being really invited. You're fighting your way into...
That's right. I mean, most people are fight to get out of jail. I have to fight to get into jail because they see me as a coercive power. They don't want people to have any power, you know, the figures of authority. Middle management and senior management of correctional institutions are usually fairly intelligent, bright, insightful people. But the people that are wearing the blue uniforms, the four batoos or the screws or, you know, officers or whatever you want to call them, they're not over-endowed with intelligence as a rule. You know, that might be a bit of a generalisation. There's probably some decent people that are doing that sort of job, but my experience of people that do their job is that they are people who are from working class backgrounds who have been repressed and bullied all their lives anyway and come to that job with little education and then give out all those bullying techniques that have been put onto them over the years. They multiply them out and terrorise the prisoners. So the prisoners are quite keen to have someone come in there and run a workshop because they're not seeing anyone that is meaningful to them in their lives, and, you know, I filled a void.
Reading some of your poetry, I've read some of your poems several times now. Is it fair to say that they're deceptively simple?
What I try to achieve, Richard, is contrived simplicity. I think often you might think, well, this poem has only been written once. Well, the poem has been written six times or seven times. There would be very few poems that I would publish under six or seven drafts, and that has been the process that I've used all the way through. You know, you shouldn't need a Bachelor of Arts degree or, you know, or a Master's degree or, you know, any sort of degree to understand a poem. You know, the people who vacuum the floors here at the ABC, the people who unblock the toilets, they should be able to understand a poem equally as much as the CEO of the ABC.
I mentioned before you're a very physically fit man. Once you had your back injury, obviously physio was going to be the thing that fixed it in the end. You kept up a very, very strong exercise regime. What would that involve?
About 15 years, no, more than that, 18 years ago, I stopped smoking. I was a very heavy smoker, and I'd been quite a heavy smoker throughout my life. But 18 years ago, I stopped when my daughter, Grace, was 1 year of age, and I thought, if I'm going to be here for her 21st birthday, I'd better pull this up now. I used to buy two cartons a week, and they sat on the top of the fridge, and I'd just grab packet after packet after packet, and in the morning I'd get up, I'd get her out of the bassinet, change a nappy, take her out on the deck, put her in the bouncer net, and I'd generally hack and have a spit, light up an Escort Red, sip a cup of coffee, and I'd read her nursery rhymes and talk to her and tell her stories and give her animated faces and poke my tongue out and just be playful. And then one morning she'd got past the stage of sitting in the bouncer net and she'd start to toddle. And I just put her on the deck and she got up, stood up, and she toddled to the edge of the deck, grabbed hold of the railing and went tch, and started imitating me spitting. And I thought, what am I doing? I'm teaching her to get up in the morning, come outside, have a spit and light up an Escort Red. And I thought, this is no way to bring up a child. And I thought, if I'm going to be here for her 21st birthday, it's curtains for smoking. And I stopped as soon as I finished those two cartons.
But then there was the swimming
and
the running.
I put the weight on, you see, after that, because most people will, when they stop smoking, they will start to compensate by eating. So I thought, I've been told that I'm not allowed to run, and that, you know, I should only ever swim backstroke and not swim freestyle. So I thought, well, I've been told a lot of things in my life, and I was living on the Esplanade at Semaphore. And I went over the beach one morning and I ran from jetty to jetty, which was a mile. And then I thought, well, I'll go for a swim. And I thought, I'm only allowed to swim backstroke. And I thought, I don't like swimming backstroke. I'm going to swim freestyle. So I swam freestyle and I started extending the length of the swim. And then I thought, I reckon I could swim jetty to jetty. So I started swimming a mile every morning. I'd swim one direction and run back. And then I'd repeat it again in the afternoon. And I did that for many years. I was in Tasmania and I entered an 8-kilometre run on Mother's Day, the Mother's Day Classic in Hobart, and I placed second for my age at 57 years of age and felt, you know, very proud of myself, felt quite invincible, would have liked to have won, but was happy to come second for my age. And 3 months after that, I've got Jack Dancer and I've got a 250-gram tumour, you know, floating around in my neck. I thought, it's all over Red Rover, you know. Well, I was told it was all over Red Rover, but again, I fought back. Yesterday morning, which is the third anniversary of my neck surgery yesterday, 12 months ago, I was 2.1 kilograms lighter than I was this year.
The upshot is I'm looking at a man who's 60 years old, who's strong enough to hold a bull out to urinate, to paraphrase my old man. Now, we come to the story of your cancer, Jeff, and I could ask you to tell that story, but really, it's told in a poem. I'd love you to read part of it. We'll put the whole of the poem on our website, but I'll ask you to read part of it now. And before I get you to read it, I'll just have to give a quick language warning before we get started.
It's called The Seventh Doctor. The first doctor I saw was my local GP. He said I had the flu, and the lump in my neck was bunched up muscle. He told me to go home, drink plenty of water, and eat Panadine Forte and Valium. I saw him again 5 days later and told him I'd hardly slept. He sent me home once more and told me to add sleeping tablets to the mix. 2 days later, when I was dangerously dizzy, like Dad when he was drunk and disorderly, I drove myself to the public hospital. Some people said to me later I was silly and should have called an ambulance. But I'm not in the ambulance fund. I didn't have money for a taxi. And I'm an independent bastard too. After a near sideswipe to a neighbour's car just 100 metres from home, I sat up pretty quick, thinking of the thickness of a coat of paint, and I rolled the windows down and caught the breeze. It was a slow 5K drive. After a few minutes in the emergency waiting room, I thought I was going to fall off the chair, so I asked to lie on a stretcher. A man with a grey flecked beard came across and spoke. He said they were reserved for sick people, I should stay in my chair. I told him he'd be sick if he didn't wheel a stretcher over for me now. After I'd lain down, he leaned over me and said, "You'll have to get off it if someone comes in who really needs it." I suggested he'd better be able to fight if he thought I'd be getting off. It only took another 5 hours and I was moved to see the second doctor. When he saw how awkward I was and noticed how long it took me to sit upright and saw I hadn't shaved for a week and heard my slurred speech, he folded his arms and told me to go home, have a sleep, and go back and see that first doctor. I told him to get fucked. Met his eyes and said that if he didn't look at me properly, I'd spread him over the floor. After a look and a feel, he sent me for a CAT scan. When I returned, he said, "I've called in a specialist. You might have to wait for an hour or so because he's coming from another hospital." When I saw the third doctor, he said, "You are very sick. You have an infected abscess and it's very close to the voice box. You'll need to go into a bed upstairs. You may need an operation in the morning." When they got me installed upstairs, I saw the fourth doctor. He said, "You'd better prepare yourself. This could be the big C." I thought I'd already met the big C when I saw that second doctor. In the morning, I met the fifth doctor, a woman, who one day later told me I did have cancer. But the way she told me made me think she was the big C. The lady doctor told me to go home. She said they'd bring me the time to go to another hospital, to see another doctor. After a week when no one had rung, I rang the hospital. I spoke to a sixth doctor who told me they never said they would ring me. He said that I was confused, that I should wait for a phone call or a letter. I told the sixth doctor that maybe he was confused. I said I remembered what I'd been told. He said, "No, you are confused. We will tell you when we want to see you, and we'll do that by letter or phone, whatever suits us best. If you don't like it, you know what to do. You can go private and call the tune and have doctors suit your timetable." I reminded the Sixth Doctor I was a public patient and had no private cover. But I told him too I was an old-fashioned bloke. I said, I'll keep an eye on the letterbox and an ear out for the phone, but I'll go outside every hour and check the roof for homing pigeons. So feel free to send your instructions by carrier pigeon. I've got a long ladder and a 17-foot-high wall, and I feel quite confident I can climb the ladder and open up the metal band and retrieve any messages you might like to send. I'm happy to use the old technology or the new. I'll leave it up to you. The Sixth Doctor suggested we end the call. With respect, I said, maybe I'm confused and I don't really have cancer. Can you confirm that I actually do have cancer? Yes, he replied, you do. And can you confirm that I did have an ultrasound examination? Yes, he replied, you did. And while I freely admit I don't have much medical knowledge, I do have a good understanding of the nuances of language and speech. And I do believe when the ultrasound examination was carried out, there was a good deal of surprise in the voices of the five or six people behind me in that darkened room. Would you agree on that point? Yes, he replied, I agree. And while I don't want to appear pedantic, would you agree that four, or perhaps even five biopsy samples were removed during that examination? I'm sure I do remember the pull on the flesh. And I'm sure I heard instructions on how deep to go. 1.5 centimetres, 2 centimetres, etc., etc. I mean, I won't argue on the number of biopsies or the depth of the needles. It's the procedure I'm referring to. Would you agree that I did, in fact, have several biopsy samples taken? Yes, he replied. I agree. Well, thank you, I said. I'll keep an eye on the letterbox, an ear out for the phone, and I'll check the roof hourly. Thank you, Doctor, for your decency, your humanity, and your kindness. And we both hung up. After a few more weeks, I got to meet the Seventh Doctor, a surgeon, a decent bloke who showed me decency and got it in return. He explained my condition in a language I could understand. His handshake was as solid as his eye contact, and I liked his style. The Seventh Doctor had me lie on the operating table for a biopsy on my tongue because they couldn't locate my primary. The cancer in my neck was a secondary. On the day of the op, he and his team all wore blue overalls, white gumboots, caps, and masks. They looked like concrete finishes on a building site, but their hands were soft and their valves were rounded. Before I was sent off to sleep, the Seventh Doctor talked to me about painting and Robert Hannaford and poetry and art as therapy. He sure didn't sound like a concrete finisher. When I woke, I was put into a ward of other old men who coughed all night and kept one another awake. And when the screen curtains were drawn in the morning, I asked a man alongside me if he'd like a Rothman's plane. In his morning haze, he couldn't fathom my joke.
That's part of the poem, The Seventh Doctor, from Jeff Goodfellow's collection of poetry called Waltzing with Jack Dancer. There's another line further on in that poem, Jeff, where you come out of your operation and you have the abscess and the tumour from your neck removed.
Yep.
And your girlfriend and your youngest son, Paul, were there to greet you. And they said, quote, the wound looked like I'd been carved up with a broken flagon.
A bottle would have been far too small.
It's an amazing line in a poem. It brings up, I suppose, the harshness of surgery along with the brutality of a bar fight.
Yeah, well, the morning after it had happened, I had to get out of bed to have a shower. You have to wash the wound, and I wasn't keen to wash the wound. And I was from a public hospital, so I'm in a ward of six men. Across the road from me was a prisoner with a guard sitting out the front of their hospital room to stop them from escaping, and I had to go past him to get to the toilet. And as I went past the guard, I said, have you seen a bloke with a broken bottle? And cracked him up, and the prisoner looked at me and said, you must have done a whack, mate. So I made a new friend there. Yeah.
Your daughter's written this story at the end of your book, and it's very moving, and she's a teenager. It's really her own reaction to your diagnosis.
And, exactly.
And going through
and
it with you.
She was in year 11 and year 12 when I had cancer, and she lives with me full time. So she was there for the full horror of it, and she got very sick herself. But unbeknownst to me, she wrote the story, and it was her last opportunity to enter that competition, and she had to get the school principal to sign off her entry. So I went with her into the school. The school principal started to read it and looked over at me and said, "What do you think of the story?" And I said, "Well, I don't know." I said, "She won't tell me what the story is called. She won't tell me what the content is." And I said, "I'm just here to support her as her father."
She wouldn't let you look at it?
No, I hadn't seen it. She would not let me know the title of the story.
Why not?
Because she thought that I might offer some criticism, or I might say I should have a comma here or a semicolon there, or, you know, whatever. She's a very independent person, my daughter, and she has won, you know, the kudos that she has got thus far off her own bat without any editorial work by me. I mean, she's a natural talent, I think. I think she's got a good deal more talent than what I have, and I expect that she'll do some remarkable things.
The whole thing's a tribute to you.
And yeah.
And it tells your story. So what was it like when you actually got to read it, Jeff?
She said, "I'm going to give it to him on Christmas Day." And I said, "Okay, sweet. You know, that's fine by me." And, you know, Sister Judy Redden signed it off and gave it to her and said, "Good luck with it, Grace," and blessed it. And away it went. And on Christmas morning, I'm down rattling the pots and pans and cooking breakfast, and in walked Grace. And I'd forgotten that she was going to give it to me, because it was probably 6 or 7 weeks prior to that that these arrangements had been made. And I'm cooking, and she walked in. She says, "Good morning." And I said, "Good morning." And she said, "Here's your Christmas present," and passed it to me as I'm at the stove and I'm cooking. And I could see the look on her face that she wasn't pleased with the fact that I hadn't turned the gas stove off. And I thought, I'm halfway through cooking these poached eggs and I'd really like to have breakfast. And then I realised, and I thought, oh, it's A4 size package. And I thought, that's that story that she was going to give me. So I turned the gas off, sat down, and I got 3/4 of the way down. As soon as I opened it, and when I saw the title page, the C word, I thought, oh, I know what it's about then now. And I read the first page and I had tears streaming down my cheeks. And I had to stop and have another go, and I read the second page. And I was a blubbering mess, and I said, "Grace, you know, I'm going to have to read this in bits and pieces." And that's what I did through the course of the day. I read it in little bits and pieces until I'd worked my way through it. And at the end of reading it, I said, "I'll tell you this right now. I told you that if ever you get invited back to that literary festival that I wouldn't go with you." I said, "But I will go with you again if you win." And I said, "You should win outright for this." I said, it is a sensational story. And I said, "I'm not just saying that because I'm your father. I'm saying it because, you know, it is a great piece of writing." And sure enough, she got shortlisted. She didn't win the outright award. She got shortlisted for it, but I went up there with her and supported her at the event, and very proud to see her get it shortlisted. It is a fantastic piece of writing.
How are you now?
Well, I've bought a couple of new pairs of shoes, Richard, and I think that says something about my long-term aspirations. I wouldn't be spending $220 on a pair of shoes unless I thought I was going to get some miles out of them.
They're pretty flash, aren't they?
I'm expecting to wear. They are. They're very flash. I'm a flash man. I'm a flash operator.
Do you think of yourself now as a fortunate man?
Oh, very much so.
Or a guy who's got what he's got by fighting against adversity?
No. A bit of both, I suppose. I mean, I don't think you'd get anything in life without a fight. You know, I haven't had anything handed to me, but I started to recognise after I got cancer that people did really respect me and they loved me.
That's the perfect note to end on. Jeff Goodfellow, thank you so much for being my guest.
Good on you, Richard.
I spoke with Jeff Goodfellow in 2011. Jeff's new memoir, Out of Copley Street, A Working Class Boyhood, is being published this month. We got in touch with Jeff, and he said he's had to give away all that swimming and running due to his health being, quote, pretty shithouse after going a few rounds with pneumonia. But in any case, he says being in lockdown in Adelaide suits him very well, and he's been, as he puts it, as busy as a tin of worms. We'll put details of Jeff's books up on our website. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.